You're listening to the GP Soccer Podcast with your host, Giovanni Puccini. Today's GP Soccer Podcast is brought to you by the DiBernardo Soccer School. Hey there, everyone. Giovanni Puccini here of the GP Soccer Podcast. Welcome to another episode. Got another terrific interview guest today. An interview guest with a background that's a little bit of a departure of the type of guests we've had on the past. Our guest today will be Brett Johnson. And we will be indeed talking about development. Not coach development, not player development, but real estate development. And you say, well, why real estate development, Giovanni? Well, this has a very significant soccer twist to it. I think you'll find very intriguing. And certainly the folks who are listening down in Rhode Island will be very intrigued by all of this, because this is an area, specifically in Pawtucket, where Brett will be spearheading a rather significant real estate project that will include a soccer-specific stadium. But that's a little bit of a tease right there. We'll get into our conversation with Brett on the other side of the commercial break. We've had some great feedback, and I'm so pleased when I get feedback, and I do get a lot of feedback. Last couple of shows in particular, our last episode with Frank Dellapa, the noted soccer journalist from the Boston Globe. We get a lot of great feedback. That was a little bit of a history lesson, if you will, about soccer, not only nationally, but particularly here in the New England area. That got some great feedback. And I got to tell you, I personally have listened to that show a handful of times myself, being a bit of a history buff. And if you listen to the show, you now know that, but certainly a soccer history buff. That was a lot of fun. We got some great feedback. And then the prior broadcast, the coaches show. Where I fielded a number of email inquiries from folks from different youth soccer and club organizations and tried to, the best of my ability, answer their questions regarding various areas of coaching the game of soccer. So great to get that kind of feedback. I'm so pleased that the reception for all the shows, but in those two in particular, most recently have been welcomed by my listening audience. So thank you very much. Continue to listen. As you all know, you can find the GP Soccer Podcast pretty much anywhere you download your podcasts, and I keep everything updated primarily through Facebook. So if you punch in the GP Soccer Podcast on Facebook, up will come all the information you need regarding the show. So moving along, shameless plug. You know, during this COVID-19 pandemic, a lot of soccer has been shut down. There has been, you know, here and there, soccer being played at the high school level and in the club level, youth level, obviously with some very significant modifications because of the COVID-19 situation. Some, you know, not playing at all because in the area of which they are functioning, you see some pretty significant levels of the outbreak. So it is in the collective best interest not to play. But nonetheless, there is still some soccer left to be out there. And, you know, I have been an advocate for coaches who have been, quote-unquote, kind of shut down. In other words, they're not coaching their teams. To use this time as an opportunity. Again, go back to shameless plug. I just recently completed via Open University, which is a online university located in England. And I completed a badge certification as a coach developer, which is different than a coach educator. Now, what is the difference? Well, kind of in a nutshell, if you're, let's say you're a teacher, you know, most teachers or most departments will have a department head. And that person's responsibility is to ensure that you stay up to date with latest methods, best practices relative to the subject matter of which you are teaching. They don't get into the nuts and bolts or the nuances of the content you're teaching, but your capacity to effectively teach it. That's what a coach developer does. We don't get into X's and O's. We don't get into methodologies, but we try to help. We try to guide coaches under our care to become better teachers of the game using best teacher methods, best teacher practices, if you will. So I completed that because a lot of what I had going on has been pretty much shut down. And so you've got this free time, if you will, to do other things. And I have decided to better myself. I took online the U.S. soccer grassroots courses, even though I teach them extensively through United Soccer Coaches. What the heck? They're available. They're inexpensive. And I found them to be very informative and certainly helped me be better versed in educating folks relative to grassroots level soccer. So I took all the grassroots online courses from U.S. Soccer, and I'm in the midst now of becoming a certified personal trainer, combining my background in physical education and sports science, and all that kind of stuff, and ultimately getting certified in that. Why not? Well, I mean, why not? These are opportunities to make me a better coach, a better clinician, a better teacher of the game, being more well versed, if you will, in a variety of areas that will affect my ability to teach and coach the game. So, shameless plug, but you know, hopefully used to inspire all of you out there who are kind of in the same boat that you haven't been coaching, but you know, it's an opportunity to better yourself, as I did here. On a little bit more of a somber note, switching gears, a good friend, colleague, has passed away, that being Tony Waiters. Tony Waiters. Tony Waiters was the original director of goalkeeping for the NSCAA, now United Soccer Coaches, and passed away just recently at the age of 83. Tony, besides being a great guy, was an English international. He was a goalkeeper. Coach of the Canadian national team. I managed the Vancouver Whitecaps in the old North American Soccer League days, and guided Canada into the 1986 World Cup. And you know, aside from a stellar resume, I had the great opportunity to work literally alongside Tony, and I found him to be such a warm and friendly guy. With such a resume, you know, you think, geez, it could be an intimidating individual. He was anything but. I recall one of the earliest times I worked with Tony. We were doing a then NSCAA goalkeeping course down in Bloomsburg in Pennsylvania. And we were, you know, watching a candidate doing a session. And he called me over, hey, sit down. And I, you know, grabbed my chair and I plopped myself next to the great Tony Waiters. And a few minutes, we had some nice conversation, and at one point he says, "Hey, Giovanni, what do you think of this guy? What do you think about this?" And I was taken aback a little bit by, I'm like, "You're asking me?" You know, you have that moment of, "My goodness, this is Tony Waiters. This is a guy who's got an extraordinary level of experience, and he's asking me." I certainly shared my opinion. I don't back off. But it was the beginning of relationships, opportunities. When we work together to have those kind of conversations, he will be missed. He will be greatly missed by our coaching organization, certainly by the folks up in Canada, and by the soccer world in general. So we lost a great one. And coupled with that, not to be Debbie Downer here, but you know, a few years ago we lost another great one, Tony DiCicco, who took the reins from Tony Waiters to direct the goalkeeping academy for the then NSCAA, now United Soccer Coaches, and we lost the great Tony DiCicco as well. So we lost two icons in the last few years, and I, you know, so privileged to say that I worked alongside both of them and learned a great deal from both of them and consider them friends, colleagues, and above all, they were mentors. They were mentors. They had a great impact on the game. They had a great impact on the position of goalkeeping. You know, then, and well, I guess that an impact that shall continue now and forever. So, Tony Waiters passing, Tony DiCicco passing a few years ago. So, our guest today is Brett Johnson. As I noted earlier, we're going to take a very brief commercial message, and on the other side, we'll have a conversation with Brett Johnson. This is Giovanni Pacini. This is the GP Soccer Podcast. I'll catch you on the other side. What if I were to tell you that there is an opportunity to experience cutting-edge soccer coaching education for incredible prices? A program where you can choose a youth diploma, senior diploma, or cognitive soccer diploma. How about taking courses that are designed to deliver impactful information that will change the way you teach the game? Well, that can all be found at the DiBernardo Soccer School. Coach Marcus DiBernardo is a worldwide leader in cognitive soccer coaching, and his work has been featured in Europe, South America, and in the United States. Most recently, he was the only American invited to present at the Conference for Soccer and Neuroscience. The DiBernardo Soccer School proudly announces the first ever Virtual Director of Coaching program. This one-of-a-kind program partners with your club is 100% customizable and features such options as Coach DiBernardo training your coaches virtually, providing your club with comprehensive coaching methodologies for every age group, ideas for business development, providing marketing materials for your club website, and so much more. For further information, visit CoachDiBernardo.com or contact Marcus DiBernardo at CoachDiBernardo@gmail.com.
Hi, this is Renato Capobianco, the men's soccer coach at Regis College, and you're listening to the GP Soccer Podcast hosted by Giovanni Pacini.
And welcome back to the GP Soccer Podcast. I am your host. You know who I am. I'm Giovanni Pacini. Welcome back. As I noted before the commercial break, I'm looking forward to today's conversation with Brett Johnson. Looking forward to this interview because it's a bit of a departure from what we typically discuss here in the GP Soccer Podcast, as you all very well know by now. It is a coach, player-driven kind of podcast, as I've noted on numerous occasions. We try to make each one of these broadcasts a mini coaching education course, where at the end of it all, you kind of walk away from listening a little bit more enlightened, a little bit more educated. This is indeed going to focus around soccer, but from a different vantage point, from a development vantage point, some exciting things that are going to be happening down in the state of Rhode Island. So, with that said, as I noted, our guest today on the GP Soccer Podcast is Brett Johnson. He is the founder and partner of Fortuitous Partners, a diversified opportunity fund platform investing in professional sports anchored multi-asset developments in opportunity zones. Mr. Johnson is the co-chairman of the Phoenix Rising Football Club, a USL championship professional soccer team based in Phoenix, Arizona. In 2005, Mr. Johnson founded Benevolent Capital, a private equity fund with investments in real estate, manufacturing, and consumer brands, including Phoenix Rising Football Club, Octagon Partners, Archer DX, TerraCycle, and NYC Office Suites. Mr. Johnson is currently overseeing a sports anchor development project called Tidewater Landing, which will be located in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. So, Brett, welcome to the GP Soccer Podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure and an honor.
Fantastic. Well, we'll find out if it's a pleasure or not when it's all said and done.
fair enough.
There you go. So here's where I always like to start with all my guests. And my regular listeners know that I really like to start with something like this. I'm always curious about, you know, people's, soccer lives. Like, you know, when you were a kid, you know, where you grew up, where you played. Did you have any, folks that you looked up to in the soccer world? Kind of take us through from the soccer standpoint, the Brett Johnson soccer story to the point where you're at now, what you're involved with the game.
Sure. No, I appreciate that opportunity. Well, so as I refer to it, I was born and raised on the mean streets of the Upper East Side in New York City and, survived that upbringing. But, you know, my soccer pedigree was in Central Park during a time where Central Park's dramatically better or different today than it was when I grew up. But kind of playing soccer on dirt fields and always loved the sport. But, you know, over time, especially when I ended up going to high school, I started recognizing that sort of my athletic future lay elsewhere and ultimately started to focus on two very different sports, lacrosse and crew. I was I eventually rode at Brown, which in some respects is a good segue ultimately to the Rhode Island project. But in the meantime, always loved the sport and my true passion and commitment to the sport came during a period of time where I was living in England in the late 90s and had a front row seat to a lot of the Premier League games and traveling all over the world and kind of recognizing the religion by which the sport is revered all over the world and had a thesis that over time kind of North America and in particular the States would catch up both on and off the pitch, if you will.
So your background primarily is in lacrosse and in crew. So you kind of like a lot of people kind of fell in love with it as you made your way overseas. So you find yourself involved with the game, particularly at the professional level, in Phoenix, Arizona. Share with us that journey, how you landed in Phoenix or how you got involved with Phoenix Rising, in particular the co-ownership you have with Didier Drogba. That's always an intriguing part of the story. So how did this Phoenix Rising portion of your life play out?
Yeah, so you have to back up to 2014 And I was watching the MLS Cup Finals. And if I remember my details correctly, LA Galaxy were playing Houston Dynamo, and Galaxy won the game. But during halftime, Don Garber gives a kind of state of the union, if you will, relative to MLS, and in particular on the expansion side. And what I found interesting was he didn't mention Phoenix. And given that it's the fifth biggest city, it's the best, arguably demographically, and it's the fastest growing city in the States. I kind of looked at all of that and said to myself, I actually turned to my wife after the game and I said, I want to raise money and buy a Major League Soccer franchise, and I want to call it Phoenix Rising. And I started to kind of look at that potential. And during my diligence, I uncovered that there was a USL franchise there called Arizona United. And I also started to recognize that the pathway for a lot of expansion markets in MLS was coming through either USL or, at the time, NASL. And so I kind of pivoted and recognized that I needed to try to find a way to invest in Arizona United, which I did. I ended up having a partnership with Kyle Hang, who was the founder of Arizona United. And we started to really learn a great deal about what I'll call the challenges of owning professional sports and, you know, trying to build a franchise. And along the way, Kyle had kind of recognized that relative to both the time and financial commitment, you know, his real focus lay elsewhere. And so it gave me the opportunity to start to look for other partners. And I was absolutely blessed to bring in what I would call sort of a world-class group of local partners, including especially Berke Bakay, who's co-chairman with me of Phoenix Rising. And Berke and Mark Detmer and Tim Reeser, I mean, the local ownership group is a who's who. Each one sort of more dedicated, committed than the next. And each one, you know, has either experience and relationships that, as we really started to rebrand the team to ultimately Phoenix Rising and build a stadium in record time, became instrumental in kind of turning the franchise to where it is today. Relative to Didier, Berke Bakay deserves all the credit for that. Berke had turned early on in the process of rebranding this and had stated that he was going to get Didier Drogba to finish up his career with us. And I've got to tell you, I think Berke is really only one of the only individuals in the world who could have possibly made that happen. And it's a testimony to his conviction, but he was absolutely hell-bent on getting Didier to come and consider finishing up his career and then ultimately joining the ownership group. But Didier, I remember early on, Didier did come for 2 days, sort of a due diligence, and we hadn't even built our stadium yet. And I remember at one point we were trying to explain to Didier where we were going to put this stadium. And it was classic because a tumbleweed, like it was literally out of like a Hollywood film, like a tumbleweed literally started going by Didier as we're pointing to this field. And we're saying, yeah, that's where the stadium's going to be. And I kind of caught Didier looking at his watch, like kind of looking to try to figure out if he could take an earlier flight to get out of here, get out of Phoenix. But to the collective ownership's credit, we built a stadium in a record time. We started selling out every single game, and Didier came back and he was absolutely blown away. And then he committed to coming up. He finished his career playing 2 seasons for us, helped get us to the playoffs both years. We lost in the finals in his final year with us. And it really helped kind of change certainly the culture and the performance of the team on the field, having someone of his pedigree. I don't have enough platitudes to talk about him, both as an individual and then obviously as a player.
Well, having been to Arizona a number of times in my life, Brett, I can visualize the tumbleweed rolling by, which is a common occurrence if you're from that area, but I'm sure quite strange to someone coming in from out of the country. I'm intrigued, and having done some additional research for this conversation, I'm intrigued, and I would like for you to kind of tie in this idea of A, opportunity zones, and this idea of sports-anchored development, which it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, Phoenix Rising, this development effort in Phoenix coincided with that idea of a sports anchor development effort?
Yeah, that's absolutely accurate. So very early on in the process of, so in 2017, there was a updated tax bill, you know, I think it's the Trump tax bill. And one of the programs in there, which was truly one of maybe the only part of that bill that had true bipartisan support, that, you know, both sides of the aisle, Democrats and Republicans, came together to craft the program. And it was focused on getting private capital to invest in newly created opportunity zones. And these are almost 9,000 locations across the country, designated census tracts that, you know, have on a relative basis, they sort of punch below their weight class in terms of investment and, you know, every single economic criteria that you would normally look at that would ostensibly be of interest or attract capital and certainly private capital. And when I became familiar with the program, I certainly thought of Phoenix because our aspirations are to build a far more substantial stadium and then develop real estate around it, which is, you know, obviously a common playbook with professional sports. And you can use countless examples across the country. You can take an LA Live in my city. You can take Atlanta SunTrust Park. I mean, the list goes on. You could take Patriot Place just up the road from Rhode Island. So I started to think about how we could leverage professional sports, soccer in particular, USL even more particularly, and leverage the Opportunity Zone program, taking private capital and create not just a sports, but a multi-asset. So look at housing and ideally, you know, a bunch of different asset classes within housing, including workforce and affordable. Look at developing office, retail, hotel, and truly transform a community by providing, you know, an economic, social, live, work, play hub that's going to not only manifest itself in hundreds of millions of dollars investment, but obviously create an incredible amount of jobs and economic activity that candidly, if not for all of this, might not be there, might not, you know, materialize.
It sounds like, you know, when you talk about projects like this, I mean, you know, it's going to have some significant economic impact relative to the community. But as you very well know, this is a public-private situation. It sounds like Phoenix in that area was very receptive to working with you and sorting out those public-private issues, infrastructure, and all the things that go along with this type of effort. Did you get any pushback? Was it openly received from the get-go? What were some of the hurdles, if any, that you faced in moving forward with such an expansive project in the city of Phoenix?
So actually in Phoenix, right now or to date, we have a very modest, what's referred to as a pop-up stadium. And we're leasing land in a very good location from one of the Indian tribes in the Phoenix community. And that's been a fantastic partnership. It's served us very well. But our aspirations in Phoenix will certainly be to look at a more permanent location, a far more substantive stadium, and that should be translated as sort of 15,000, 20,000 seats, and then all the real estate that you'd want to develop around there, and including playing fields for all of our youth programs, which are in the state of Arizona. We have over 10,000 kids that are under the Phoenix Rising flag. But it's just a long way of saying that actually, I would love to be further along with Phoenix, but for a lot of reasons, that will actually post-seed, if you will, the Rhode Island and the Tidewater Landing project. We've made considerable project in that market. And I guess specific to Rhode Island, as I started to think about the aspirations in the Phoenix market and leveraging all these different components, I also started to think about the fact that USL is an outstanding platform to bring professional soccer franchises into communities and then try to figure out, again, all these different pieces, creating jobs, social impact. And for a lot of reasons, Rhode Island really resonated. It's got some of the best demographics and interest for the sport of soccer. And it doesn't, and obviously was lacking a professional team. And then the added, I guess, you know, scenario that obviously with the Paw Sox announcing they were picking up and moving, it was losing an iconic and historic franchise. So there was, on an added basis, there was a kind of a professional sports vacuum of sorts that was starting to be created. And then it had some prime opportunity zone real estate in the city of Pawtucket, right on the water, right off I-95. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons why I call my firm Fortuitous Partners. And, you know, there were a great number of elements that kind of came together to start making that a reality. And I'm very proud of where the project is to date, especially given all the challenges of COVID and the environment we're in right now. And I'm particularly proud and optimistic of where I think it's going to be when, you know, in a couple of years, we've obviously cutting the ribbon on the broader development.
So before we dive deeper into the Tidewater Landing project, is this the ownership group, as you noted with Phoenix Rise, is this the same ownership group that will oversee the eventual USL Rhode Island franchise?
No, I'm glad you asked that. It's not. The only common denominator would be myself. My partners in Phoenix are incredibly supportive of the Rhode Island project and initiative. But for a host of different reasons, you know, this is my full-time endeavor. I've launched Fortuitous Partners specifically to look at sports anchored development through the OZ construct. Rhode Island is the bright, shiny object. And most importantly, it's very personal for me. I intend on being the principal owner of this USL franchise. I'm excited to take what I would say is all the lessons that I've learned through the success of Phoenix Rising and start to apply it in that market. And you know, my family is all from the East Coast. My wife's family is right across the border in Mystic, Connecticut. So I have a great deal of ties. So I'm excited to kind of really see this program success and put my fingerprints on it. And but it was never endeavor where I turned to the Phoenix Rising ownership group and I said, hey, would you guys all like to join me at this? They all have their different day jobs, if you will, and they've got enough appetite with their current equity interests, obviously in Phoenix Rising.
Did you have to sever your ties with Phoenix Rising formally? Well, I know you were co-chairman. Are you?
Yeah, still... I remain co-chairman. I do think for a host of reasons, when we officially launch the Rhode Island franchise, I will step down as co-chairman. I'll stay on the board of Phoenix Rising and I'll retain my equity interest in Phoenix Rising. But you know, the good news is that they're in two different divisions, the East and West of USL Championship. And look, God willing, they find a way to play each other in the finals, because that's based on the current structure of the USL. That's the only time the two would ostensibly meet with each other. But as long as I'm not principal owner of both, there's nothing to preclude kind of equity interest in multiple professional USL soccer teams.
So in front of me, I do have an artist rendering, as they say, of the entire project, including the soccer stadium, and it is indeed impressive. And I know the area very well. I'm here just outside the Boston area, but I'm a short 35-minute drive to Pawtucket. In fact, as you very well know, I serve as a director of coaching education for the Superliga, which is situated in the state of Rhode Island. So, and I've done a lot of work as a coach educator for Pawtucket Youth Soccer. So I'm intimately aware of the vibrancy of the soccer community down there. So with all that said, you know, I know there's some sensitivity or there's certain things you can and can't talk about relative to the project as a whole. What can you share with my audience about the entirety of the development project, including the soccer stadium?
Yeah, so the intention, aspiration, objective, et cetera, is that we will privately finance what will ultimately be a 15,000 seat rectangular, you know, and that should be read as soccer specific stadium. You know, you can put American football and rugby and lacrosse and field hockey and obviously, you know, both men's and women's soccer. So it'll be a multi-purpose venue. It'll also have the ability, weather permitting, to host concerts and other outdoor events. And that will be what's officially on the Tidewater side, which is property owned by National Grid, which is a site that, if not for this project, they were going to remediate the land and probably put a fence around it. So I'm particularly proud of the fact that we're going to build what I'll describe as an iconic stadium on that site with National Grid support. And then with the broader development we're going to have on that same side, we'll end up putting a parking garage, some housing units, some retail, et cetera, so adjoining the stadium. And then we'll have a footbridge that spans the Seekonk River that connects the Tidewater side to the Division Street side. And then the Division Street side is owned by the city of Pawtucket. We've just formalized a long-term lease with the city. And the plan on that side is to put a year-round multi-purpose indoor event community center. And we intend and expect that we'll host a great deal of events in that, including e-gaming, obviously basketball, volleyball, wrestling, dance, cheer, you know, a host of maybe some smaller overflow activity from the convention center. And that will really be a sort of a 365-day driver of activity to the broader development. And then we'll also intend on having multifamily housing, retail, food hall, hotel, and office space. So it's a fairly dense project between those two sites in terms of how much program we're going to put in. But it's right now it's fantastic in opportunity in that it's prime waterfront real estate that's never been developed, but candidly it should be developed, and it should be not just the pride of Pawtucket, but it should be for the broader state as a whole. And so I feel very honored and fortunate with the support that we have from the city, from Commerce Department, from all of the sort of broader political spectrum of Rhode Island to have the opportunity to kind of bring this to fruition. I'm fortunate with an incredible extended team that's kind of got their fingerprints on this and are working hard to try to make it a reality.
Given the magnitude of the project, I'm assuming, correct me if I'm wrong, this is a phased effort. Well, if that is the case, what would be phase one, phase two, and so on and so forth?
Yeah, for a lot of reasons, the stadium has to take precedent. We were trying to get the stadium done and see if we can make it for sort of a 2022 launch. That seemingly would be very, very difficult, but we have every bit of confidence and intent that 2023 we'll be launching a USL championship franchise in that stadium. But you know, that I believe strongly is obviously the linchpin for the entire project, and for a lot of reasons needs to kind of take priority from a phasing perspective. That being said, we do have interest in also kind of what I would say parallel tracking some of the other critical assets associated with the broader development. So the event center would also, we'd want to kind of time that to complete at or near the same time. And then obviously you got to join the site. So that bridge is going to be imperative. So it's a long way of saying that there just logistically, there has to be some phasing. And someone with a far greater experience than I will be the one to ultimately opine on how that comes to fruition. But we hope and intend that a great deal of it will actually complete fairly close to each other.
So let's focus in on the stadium. That obviously will house your top of the pyramid, so to speak, professional team. When it's up, it's running, it's going. You know, people are in the stands. What will the soccer the soccer program look like? More specifically, obviously, at the top of the pyramid, you have the pro team. Will you have academies? Will you have, you know, your own soccer club? You know, USL Rhode Island, for the lack of better terms, we'll call it that. USL club teams. Are you looking to create that type of soccer infrastructure in terms of player development and those types of things?
The quick answer is I'd love to. The longer answer is, you know, I need to work with individuals like yourself and Darius and what I would say is the incredible talent that's in the state of Rhode Island that I want to figure out how best the professional team, how best the stadium can be a resource and supportive for, in particular, I would say developing talent is fantastic, but I think supporting boys and girls and supporting the amateur ranks within the state of Rhode Island.
So yeah, obviously that's well done. You haven't put the shovel in the ground yet. My next question in all of this, and it's one I'm sure you had to ask yourself, and I'm sure it's a question you had to discuss with other folks. There's this little team up the street, up 95, called the New England Revolution. What was the thought process when you said, we're going to put a stadium, we're going to put a USL team a few minutes down the street from the New England Revolution? And the follow-up question, at least in my brain, is why should people go to you? Why should they go to, you know, USL Rhode Island and take a part that versus a short ride up the street to go see the Revs?
Yeah, so great question. I mean, first and foremost, I've had a front row seat with USL, and the quality of the league just keeps getting better and better. And what I would say is the relative performance gap between MLS and USL keeps shrinking. But regardless of that, I intend to tap into the Rhode Island pride and create a team that the state takes ownership in and migrates their support. That I believe that Rhode Island, and this is, I can almost point it out empirically, there's an incredible demographic in the state of Rhode Island that loves soccer, that consumes it, and they don't have a local team, meaning in-state, a Rhode Island professional franchise that they can call their own, and they can truly take what I would call true pride in. And with the utmost respect to the Revs, a Massachusetts-based team, candidly playing in an American football stadium with 70,000 seats, I think it's kind of apples to oranges. And it's not about competing with the Revs per se. It's about bringing USL, which is, I've seen the way our Phoenix Rising support has grown. And I've seen the way USL has, whether you can look at Sacramento, you can look at New Mexico, you can look at Indy, you can look at Louisville. When you bring USL and you do it in the right stadium, in the right market, and you got to build that grassroots support. Like I'm not trying to say like overnight that it's going to be a slam dunk in terms of overall success. You really have to build it and tap into the community. But, you know, initially our aspirations for the stadium, we're going to start with a 7,500 seat level. And in the size and state of Rhode Island at a 7,500 seat capacity in this beautiful stadium along the river with the outstanding team that I intend certainly to field, I don't think it's the greatest hurdle in the world for us to try to clear. And then over time, obviously, ideally build that up to a greater capacity where we think it'll kind of settle in at the 15,000 level. I should say as well, I'm also very interested and committed to bringing a women's professional soccer league. I think that's an incredible additional opportunity for the state of Rhode Island. And, you know, it's something that would not happen at the same time. I've got a fair bit of work to still do, but the NWSL is doing exceptionally well. The latest announcement coming out of LA, their aspirations over the next couple of years, that league's going to continue to go up to the right. So I'm focused on building a beautiful stadium and bringing the highest level of professional soccer to the state of Rhode Island for men and also for women, and ideally making it a source of pride for Rhode Islanders, first and foremost.
I think, and you know, you touched upon it in the early portion of your answer there, was your stadium. As you very well know, the New England Revolution have, it's been such a challenge for them to get a soccer-specific stadium, primarily in the city of Boston. They have faced, you know, all kinds of challenges. You know, the biggest one is, you know, getting a space, a piece of dirt, if you will, large enough to put a stadium in and all the appropriate infrastructure that goes along with that. That has been a, the one thing you have going for you. And it's a big thing, Brett, it's a big thing. You have a soccer specific stadium that holds 15,000 people that is going to create such an atmosphere. And I'm preaching the choir here, you know this. It's going to create such an atmosphere that folks, I think, are going to want to go there and experience that. That's that soccer atmosphere versus going into the rather cavernous, Foxborough Stadium, Gillette Stadium up the street. And then, this tying into the stadium too is the old NWSL. As you very well know, and I still find this hard to believe. Women's professional soccer in the Boston area has been a challenge. It has been a challenge, and it's not for a lack of trying. It's not been for a lack of trying. They've had a number of incarnations of the professional game for the women's side. But it boils down to, once again, the common denominator is the stadium finding a home. The last incarnation of the Boston Breakers, and I could be wrong, I think they ended up at Harvard. They were at BU. They were in a number of different places. They didn't have a place to call home. That's right. Stadium, and I'm looking at it now in your artist rendering here, I see that stadium being a soccer-specific home to a high-level men's professional team and maybe somewhere down the road a high-level women's professional team. So you don't see yourself, and you mentioned the word competition. I'm looking at my notes here. You don't see yourself in competition with the Revs. Is that safe to say that's the case?
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, again, I really respect – MLS and by extension, the Revs and obviously the Kraft family. You know, I think if the Kraft family could wave the magic wand, they would find a way to build a soccer-specific MLS stadium in Boston. And it would be more out of the mold of LAFC, meaning a sort of 19 to 21,000 seat venue, you know, beautifully designed. And, you know, that's been transforming MLS. I mean, MLS is going to learn their lesson that playing in large American football stadiums is not healthy for the league. You know, the only one that's been able to sort of bend the laws of gravity on that have been Atlanta and what Arthur Blank's done. But otherwise, or I guess Seattle has also
Seattle and Portland, yeah, sure.
But Portland's got a soccer specific. Right. Say, I mean, it used to be a baseball; they converted to soccer. But you know, again, I think increasingly it is about the fan experience. It's about, you know, I look at our pop up stadium in Phoenix. It's got, you know, withstanding capacity. We've topped out at 7,700 fans. I would say the noise is just infectious in terms of when you're in that venue. And that's what you want to create. And that's what people get into. And now what I see all the time is I would gladly figure out a way to get a bunch of Rhode Islanders who've never been to a professional soccer game to come and experience that electricity. And I will highly confident that like we've done in Phoenix, the amount of times where I've seen countless people who were not soccer fans come to our venue, watch our game, and they come away and they're hooked. And I think that's why, you know, obviously it's the beautiful game and you have countless testimonials about people who have one way or the other experienced soccer right, and all of a sudden they're hooked. And I look forward and ideally with a lot of other people's help to kind of replicating that in the fine market of Rhode Island.
Yeah, and you know, the demographic that you will appeal to is the casual sports fan. The soccer person is going to go. The soccer person goes to Gillette Stadium and goes see the Revs play, you know, because they're soccer people.
Yeah.
But that environment, which you have just described, and I'm looking at it here in the picture again, the casual sports fan, when they get a little taste of that, you've got to believe that they will, you know, they might become soccer nuts, but I think you can hook them as a sports fan to, support professional soccer in that area. You know, I know folks who, you know, are casual sports fans and they've checked out a Revs game and they like soccer. Hey, this is pretty cool. I never saw that before. But the hook, I hate to beat this dead horse. I guess I'm doing you a favor. That stadium is going to be the hook for you for the casual sports fan, expanding your fan base.
That's right. And so, I think especially when you get the right supporter section and you got the drums and the music and you've got the smoke after a goal and, you know, all of a sudden you get people caught up, you know, the before game ritual, kind of enjoying food and drink with friends, marching over. I mean, imagine that, the march to the match, going from one side of the river across the bridge into the stadium, wearing the colors, you know, and getting caught up in the atmosphere. And look, what I'd also say as well is it's important that I will be very focused on trying to put as good a product on that field as we possibly can, because nothing gets people behind a team than winning. And so that's a big part as well. I mean, Phoenix Rising is, you know, we now hold the record in North America for the most wins in a row at 20 last season. And, you know, our win rate since we rebranded it is close to unparalleled. And that helps. That helps to sell tickets. I could talk about how brilliant we've been in a host of other areas. I'd tell you, you know, one of the things that's probably most important is obviously people like the team that wins.
You know, when I was a college coach, I was very fortunate to, you know, turn around some rather moribund programs and to make them into winning programs. And I had a saying all the time, winning cures everything. Winning cures everything. Whether it's small scale, in my case, you know, coaching Division III soccer, or in your case, coaching or overseeing a professional team, winning doesn't cure everything. I want to spend a moment. You mentioned a good friend of mine, Darius Shirzadi. And for folks who listen to my show, you know that Darius has been on my show. In fact, he's going to be coming up in a future broadcast of the GP Soccer Podcast. He does wonderful work with Project Goal. Share with my audience, I don't want to steal any of your thunder, what you have come to learn about Project Goal, what you've come to learn about Darius Shirzadi and the relationship and similar relationships that you look to forge in Rhode Island.
Yeah, no, thank you. I mean, I'm blown away with Darius and Project Goal. And I was very honored. Darius had asked me to sit on the board, and because of geographical reasons, I felt it best to So Peter Baptista, who works very closely with me, Rhode Island native, he's, you know, truly part of the Tidewater, by extension, the USL Rhode Island family. So he now sits on the board and not only with time, but also, you know, financially and contributing to it. And, you know, I feel like Darius and Project Dream kind of encapsulates exactly what I love about, you know, the position that I'm in, is finding ways to support, in particular, the youth side, boys and girls, getting them access, getting them to really enjoy the sport and give, and providing life lessons. So ideally, you know, regardless of what their future holds, that, you know, the exposure that they get, it makes them, you know, better individuals. And so I love supporting it, and I want to continue to obviously to expand my sort of grassroots relationships and support, you know, well beyond Darius, but that's about as good a place to start.
It's the best place to start. I don't say that because he's a dear friend, but you know, what he has done with that program is absolutely phenomenal. For those of you who are not aware of what Project Goal is, obviously I encourage you to go check it out online. But basically what Darius is doing is primarily out of Central Falls, Rhode Island, he's providing academic opportunities and academic incentives for people, for folks in lower socioeconomic communities. And the caveat, the carrot, the incentive, if you will, is playing the sport of soccer. So if you uphold, you know, academic standards and behavioral standards, you're allowed to go play soccer in the afternoon and take part in their soccer programs. And he's done such a wonderful job. He's got kids who have developed into wonderful soccer players, wonderful student athletes who've gone to play at the college level. He's done great work. I've had the great opportunity to go down there and do some work with him with Project Goal. So I definitely want you to check that out. And I'm pleased that he was one of the first, if not the first, folks in the community that you did reach out to. So let's take a step back. Let's take a look, Brett, at the game in general here in the United States. Now, I think I'm a little bit older than you, just a little. Okay, I'm 62. But a very young 62, Brett, very young 62.
I'm in. Yeah, and you just nipped me by a little bit.
Okay, just by a little bit. So, you know, in my lifetime as a fan, as a soccer professional, as one who's been involved in the game, it literally every single level for a number of years, I have seen, you know, some great progress. Without laboring that point, I still think here in the United States, we have a long ways to go. There are still hiccups that we still face relative to coach development, player development, but that's for another show. Where you sit, if you're looking, you know, the 50,000 foot looking down, soccer in America, where are we? Not just from the professional level, but, you know, moving on down from the player development level to the coach development level, in your view, where are we?
Well, I think that the youth movement that's going on right now, in particular in Europe with U.S. players, is probably as exciting as it's existed during our lifetime. The amount of young players, you know, obviously led by Pulisic, that are starting to get minutes on meaningful teams, and obviously the recent signing relative to Juventus and Barcelona. I mean, whether or not you can bring all that talent together in a short period of time at the national team and have it perform is a different question. But certainly relative to what I'd say is some phenomenal talent in the men's game, athletic talent in the men's game, getting, you know, some proper exposure, like it's an exciting time in that regard. Obviously the women go without saying. It's just been extraordinary to see how well, you know, the women have availed themselves on that World Cup stage. But I'm an optimist. I've always kind of felt like it's just a matter of time until the U.S. truly established itself formally, you know, in the top pantheon of countries relative to the sport. And for sure, we had a big setback missing the World Cup. But, you know, sometimes that adversity and sometimes those setbacks is exactly what you need, because it kind of just truly blows things up. And hopefully what can emerge makes us better and stronger as a result of it.
You know, and I've pontificated about this on numerous occasions, publicly, privately, here on my little show here. You know, I always say that here we are in the United States of America, and with the vast resources that we have, you know, I'm still a bit taken aback by the fact we're not further advanced than where we should be. Now, again, in my lifetime, which is obviously, as I mentioned, is, you know, quite long, we've come a long way, but I still a bit taken aback here, but here we are in 2020 and we're not a world power or a perennial world power, where we still have to struggle, you know, here in CONCACAF to get to fight through games with small countries that we should, for all intents and purposes, given who we are as a country, we should be spanking, I guess, so to speak. But we don't. But again, not to be a big Debbie Downer here, we have come a long way, but I still think we still have a ways to go. I want to kind of tackle, you mentioned about, you know, American players, and yes, American players have improved, certainly. You mentioned you want to win. We all want to win. Have you had the conversation in your head about when you get to that point, geez, I want to win, but I also want to make a commitment to American players, or I want to win and I'm going to find players, whether they come from Pawtucket, Rhode Island, or from Rome, Italy, or from London, England. What's your mindset about putting a quality, product on the field with the intention of making them an American talent?
Yeah, I mean, in USL, you're allowed 7 foreign players. Mm. Sometimes you can get you can buy an extra slot and get 8. But, you know, on a 22-man roster that provides, 14, 15, depending on your math and your foreign players, it's a fair bit of available slots for American players. Not to get overly technical, but it's also Canada also qualifies as North American under that scenario. So I think USL inherently provides a great deal of support. We've got some phenomenal American players who I've been blessed to see be a part of Phoenix Rising. But I also think, I believe in competition. I believe in opportunity. I think the only way you get better is you have to provide, so bringing foreign players here that help to take the domestic talent up into the right and really expose them, I think that's healthy. And, if we were going to kind of restrict further, then I think it would hurt the game, if you will. But so I applaud, I mean, MLS, I think this year is a record for homegrown talent getting minutes in MLS. And, and I think USL has been going in that same direction. And so I think if you're a young American of talent and interest and motivation, you have more options than have ever existed before. I think the challenge that has held the sport back in the States, I mean, is far beyond kind of this answer and far beyond this podcast. But, one of many things is that, there's an embarrassment of riches relative to growing up in America in terms of sports that we all play and get exposed to. And so, in many respects, historically, soccer was kind of fourth or fifth in the depth chart for a lot of people. And I do think that that's starting to change. I think World Cup coming back in 26 will be very positive. I think the Women's World Cup will likely come back, hopefully shortly thereafter, meaning the year after that. And all of those things have massive – that was the impetus behind the 94 World Cup in terms of taking the game to the next level and launching MLS. So I'm optimistic on all these different fronts, and I'm also patient on all these fronts.
You have to be. I think again, having spoken to you now and done some bit of research going into this conversation, I think, and this is just one man's opinion, Brett, I think the model of which you have embraced here, this idea of opportunity zones, these, the smaller stadiums with infrastructure, could very well be one of the driving forces in terms of player development, because you can, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're the developer here, but you can find so many wonderful places, spaces here in the United States where this works and is embraced. And you're looking at, Pawtucket, Rhode Island, or maybe, the smaller market, cities that would welcome something like this. I see this as a real driving force, a potential driving force in not only improving the level of play here in the United States, but increasing the awareness of the game here in the United States. I mean, we've arrived, but I'm sick and tired of hearing football, basketball, baseball, hockey, and we don't hear soccer yet, but this could be a contributing factor toward making an even deeper impact across the United States with developments such as we've been talking about here with Tidewater Landing. So Brett, if people wanted to learn more about Tidewater Landing, they want to learn more about, USL Rhode Island, learn more about what you're doing, what is the best way to get a hold of Brett Johnson?
Probably through my Phoenix Rising, email, which is Brett, Brett, and then it's PHX Rising, F is in football, C is in club.com. I have a Fortuitous email as well, but you know, my Phoenix Rising is just as active in email. And then, you know, there's no lack of stuff that kind of gets updated relative to Tidewater Landing in sort of the public domain. But we do have a website, which I think is the tidewaterlanding.com. Let me try see if I can confirm that.
And does that tidewaterlanding.com, does that include the picture that I'm looking at now, the artist rendering?
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
And there's a reason why I'm asking you that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So T-H-E, tidewaterlanding.com, thetidewaterlanding.com. Shows the latest rendering that we have on it, and I think you can sign up for a newsletter, which will keep people apprised of the overall project and traction, et cetera. But
and for my listening, go ahead.
Sorry. I was just going to say, I'm grateful on your show. Thank you so much.
Oh no, believe me, my pleasure, Brett. Believe me, hey Brett. At the end of the day, I'm a soccer guy. a soccer guy. Yeah.
I applaud the work that you are doing on and off the pitch, and you know, countless others like you that share this passion for. But you know, it's a collective effort, and you know, I always say that anyone who's investing what I would describe as time, and by extension, money into the sport is a friend of mine. And you know, none of this is for the faint of heart. I feel absolutely blessed with what I get to do, with the people I get to do it with, and you know, what I hope is the impact that collectively we're able to make in a bunch of different markets. And so you know, from that end, thank you to you and anyone and everyone who kind of similarly supportive to that end.
Well, certainly my pleasure to be part of the effort. I would encourage folks to check out that website and look at that artist rendering, particularly the folks in Rhode Island and also southeastern Massachusetts, and for that matter, throughout New England as well. You know, to check that it is an impressive picture. It's an impressive you know, development plans, and I think it's going to be extraordinary for soccer here, not just from Rhode Island, but for in the New England area as well. So. Terrific. Well, our guest today has been Brett Johnson, and we have been speaking at length about Tidewater Landing down here in Rhode Island, as well as work he's done with Phoenix Rising out there in Arizona. We are going to take a very, very short commercial break, I promise you. And on the other side, we'll reconnect for some more soccer talk. My name is Giovanni Pacini. You know that. This is the GP Soccer Podcast. I'll catch you on the other side. Don't you dare go anywhere. Hey, Giovanni Pacini here, host of the GP Soccer Podcast. As you all know, the main theme of the show revolves around player and coach development, both really important issues here in the United States. It's my hope that when you listen to the show, in essence, it becomes a mini coaching education course of sorts. And when you finish listening, you're that much more enlightened about the things that we as soccer coaches need to implement into our regular soccer routines and practices. If you like what you've heard, and I certainly hope that you do, well, share it. Share it with those within your own soccer network. It might be amongst those within your youth soccer or club organizations, or your soccer friends and colleagues in general. I'm hoping that this becomes coaches helping coaches. That's what I'm trying to do with the show. So, if you like what you hear, tell everyone.
Hi, this is Seth Taylor of Yanni Training, and you're listening to the GP Soccer Podcast with host Giovanni Pacini.
Welcome back to the GP Soccer Podcast. I am your host, Giovanni Pacini. I hope you enjoyed that conversation I had with Brett Johnson. I feel really fortunate in the fact that I don't live too far from Pawtucket. I do live in Massachusetts, but from where I live here, just south of Boston, in a short 35 or 40 minute drive, I am indeed in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. So when all of this kind of comes to life, this real estate development comes to life, I look forward to you know, getting down there and enjoying the new soccer specific stadium and all of the other complementary developments that Brett will be building in that area. So lots to look forward to here in the New England area, particularly in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. So thanks to Brett Johnson for being on my show. I really appreciate it. At the timing of this portion of the broadcast, and just kind of pull back the curtain a little bit, there are times when I put together a show and I might tape different portions on different dates, and you put it together, you edit it so to get a seamless broadcast. The timing of this portion coincides with two recent matches by the U.S. men's soccer team. And you know, if you know me well enough, if you, certainly you've listened to some of my shows, I've been a rather harsh critic of U.S. soccer, and in some cases still remain a harsh critic. We're going to kind of get into that, you know, in the last episode of this season of the GP Soccer Podcast. But I've got to tell you, I watched both these games. I watched the Wales game twice. This group of young players, and goodness knows, they are young. You're looking at 17, 18, 19-year-olds. You're looking at several of them making their first appearances for the U.S. national team. You know, are an exciting, dynamic, creative group of young players that come with a particular swagger not seen in a number of years. In the Wales game, they had a very short time to train for that match. From what I understand, there were only a couple of training sessions. They went into Wales on a cold, windy, rainy evening and held Wales. It was a nil-nil tie, but certainly the U.S. had some opportunities to score some goals, score a goal, and maybe win the game. But that aside, I was immensely impressed with, you know, some of the obvious cast of characters. You know, Gio Reyna, off the top of the list, son of Claudio Reyna, was just fantastic. The midfield of Yunus Musa, you know, Tyler Adams and Weston McKennie, who plays for Juve in Serie A, that threesome in particular in the midfield is going to be a midfield to be reckoned with. I dare say the more these guys, particularly that midfield set that I just mentioned, the more they play together, the more cohesive, the more dynamic, the more creative it will become. And it's the little things that really jump at me. You know, the types of passes they made, the capacity to move the ball around with such extraordinary accuracy, the speed at which the ball is moved about was really, really incredible to watch. Now, were there mistakes? Sure, there were mistakes. This is a young team that had only been together for a short period of time, and they play in a, you know, not so perfect environment, as I mentioned, with the weather. But nonetheless, what I saw in that match against Wales, who by the way was ranked 20th in the world, boy, there's a lot to look forward to there. The second match was against Panama a couple of days after. They played it in Austria, and we saw Nicolas Jochini and Sebastian Soto scored their first two international goals, and Gio Reyna, as I mentioned earlier, got his first as well. And we saw even more Americans, you know, coming into the game. Richie Ledesma comes to mind. I'm going to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, granted, it's early. I got to preface my enthusiasm here with the fact that it's early. This is a young group. It's going to take a little bit of time before the cohesiveness, you know, gets better and better. However, I don't think I personally, and I go back a ways, I cannot remember a collective group of players who were dynamic and creative as this group of young men representing the United States of America. If you have the opportunity, and they have a match or two, I think, coming up at least one before the holidays, before Christmas, please, if you have a chance to see the Wales match and the Panama game, which they scored six goals, by the way. They scored six goals against Panama. Certainly, you know, take advantage of that opportunity to watch these young men play. There's lots to be excited about. The one area I think it's a general consensus what the team lacks, at least what we've seen the last couple of games, is a true number nine, that true finisher, that true guy up top who should strike some fear in the backs and certainly a opposition goalkeeper. That was lacking, despite the fact they scored six goals against Panama. It was, you know, kind of a six by committee, if you will. We still lack that true number nine. That there are still opportunities from some MLS players. Certainly, Jose Altidore, you know, has the opportunity to maybe fill in that slot as he has done in the past. But you know that'll work itself out. In a broader sense, staying on the subject of the lack of the number nine and tying it into player development, which is, as you know, this show is all about player and coach development. That's still an issue, a lagging issue in terms of player development here in this country. The United States of America has never been known for developing, you know, world-class goal scorers. Yeah, we've had them here and there, but I can count them all in one hand and not use all my fingers. And that shouldn't be the case. This is something that can be, can be, you know, addressed at the youth development level. There are certainly methods, philosophies, approaches, mindsets that if you're a grassroots coach, you're a high school coach, there are methods that you can utilize and foster to help that cause in terms of developing truly great goal scorers, truly great number nines. And that's maybe the last piece of the development puzzle, you know, along with this group of young men that I noted. If they can get that one number nine who can do something, it's Nicholas Giochini, who knows? Maybe it's, you know, getting the old guy back, Josie Altidore. I don't know, but it's certainly an area that that needs to be addressed in terms of player development here in the United States of America. But circling back, boy, I was very excited about watching these young guys. It's the way they played the game is not a way that I have seen in many, many, many years. So if you get a chance to watch these guys play, please do so. Please do so. So that's our show for today. Thanks again to Brett Johnson for being a part of the GP Soccer Podcast. Looking forward to what's happening down in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. As you all know, if you like what you heard today, please tell everyone. If you didn't, tell everyone anyway. If you'd like to advertise on the GP Soccer Podcast, you can contact me, Giovanni Pacini, at GP4Soccer, that's the number 4, at yahoo.com or at 617-968-1800. This is Giovanni Pacini of the GP Soccer Podcast, and yes, indeed, ladies and gentlemen, I'll catch you later.